Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, children. Hope we've all been well behaved. I'm John Elledge and this is Skylines, the City Metric podcast. As I record this, it's just coming up to 5 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. I should probably have come up with sort of a more interesting intro than you're about to get, but to be honest, Theresa May might be about to resign. There's unconfirmed rumours flying around, so this could be a huge night in British politics, or alternatively, it's possibly going to be like the last 27,000 huge nights in British politics. We all get very excited and then spend the evening watching nothing happen slowly and annoyingly. So I've not really had the brain space to come up with anything interesting to say at this point. So instead, I'm just going to give you a very quick rundown of what's in this week's show. First off, we're going to go to the Centre for Cities for our regular Ask the Expert slot with Paul Swinney. When we are going to talk about international exports, cities selling to the world and the open market, with Brexit still very much a live issue, whether we like it or not, that seems topical. But really, that's just the entree for the main course, which is Patrick Maguire, the New Statesman political correspondent, making his triumphant return to Skylines. He is going to tell us about the recent attempted coup at Liverpool City Council, in which some other parts of the Labour Party attempted to defenestrate Mayor Jo Anderson. It's not gone that well, but it's a good opportunity to talk about Liverpool politics and what exactly is going on up there. So, hope you enjoy the show. By the time you hear this, it's possible Britain may have a new Prime Minister, but almost certainly it won't. Okay, well, here I am once again in the very fine offices of the Centre for Cities in London's fashionable London Bridge District. It's a beautiful day outside, which we can't see because we're inside in a meeting room with Head of Policy Paul Swinney to talk about exports. Paul, didn't we just talk about exports? Why do you want to do it again?
Well, we did talk about exporters and local services, which was quite a technical subject about different types of business that we tend to use in our research. But what we want to talk about today is about what everybody probably recognises as exports, things that go beyond our shores, goods and services that have been sold around the world. And the question is, particularly in light of Brexit, how much do our cities trade with the world? And that's what we've been looking at in our most recent research.
Well, it's global Britain, isn't it? So I'm sure our cities, if they don't trade with the world now, they bloody well will soon.
And you must have been reading Liam Fox's playbook with lines like that.
40 trade deals any minute now. Arranged by a man who should definitely be in cabinet and should not have been disqualified from ever holding a government job after the head of the civil service described him as a security risk. He's fine. He knows what he's doing. Okay, I'll stop now.
Well, fortunately, we put some data together to guide government ministers, whoever they may be, in sort of both the current and no doubt future uncertainty about what's going to happen in terms of our trade. What's interesting is that when we look across all of our UK cities, we see that all cities, bar none, send more goods and services to the EU than any other market. So it's around about an average of about 45%. Telford tops the list at around about 70% of all of its goods and exports going to the EU. So I think it's right that we talk about other trade deals, but the reality is that, you know, across the country, getting a good deal with the EU is really important for the prosperity of those places.
So sorry, did you say every city?
Every single city.
Does more international trade with the EU than with the rest of the world?
That's right, okay. Exactly.
Okay, first question, just like check our biases here. Are we sure this is like, is it possible that, you know, cities are somehow different from the non-city bits of the UK and that actually like the rest of the economy is doing vastly more trade with the world at large than it is with Europe?
the city average is actually pretty close to the national average as a whole. So when you look at cities in, as a group, they're not really diverging very much. So broadly, no. What we do see across cities is that there is a reasonable amount of variation and that some places are more reliant on an EU market than others. And no doubt you will get that in some of the more rural areas as well. But I would not expect that there'd be a huge difference even in those parts of the country because of the makeup of what we see at a national level in terms of where we send our goods and services.
Okay, so next question, why? Is there a reason that every city is more likely, or every part of the country, it sounds like, is more likely to trade with the EU than they are with the world beyond? Is it just path dependency because we've been in the EU for 46 years? Well, or is there something else at work here?
Well, I'm sure having a very preferable goods and services deal with a trading bloc of 28 neighbouring countries has probably had something to do with it. And no doubt any changes to that should be something that we should be worried of. But I think what's also important with this too is that geography does matter with these sorts of things. You know, we have got better technologies and better means of transporting goods, etc. But we do see that across the world, countries tend to trade more with their neighbours than what they trade with elsewhere. So it's right, again, that we should be looking to set trade deals with other parts of the world. But I shouldn't think we'd be expecting to now send sort of 30 or 40% of all our goods and services over to New Zealand or Australia, for example. You know, geography is important in this.
Why? I mean, is that for the obvious reason? I mean, like with goods, you can kind of understand it's easier to send a tin of baked beans to France or Belgium than it is to send it to New Zealand or Tuvalu, just because like you have to ship it further to those latter places, so that's going to bump up your costs, so it becomes less competitive, so. You know, you can see the logic there, but why does this also seem to hold true with services?
That's a good question. I think in part it's about the ability to do business with people who are closer, and it's just that little bit easier. And yes, you know, we do trade services with America. That's a slightly longer flight to get over there. America is probably looking to some of its trading partners sort of around too. I think sort of there's an element of familiarity with proximity that seems to come about in terms of our trading patterns. And that seems to influence what's going on. On the other hand, of course, if you look at from a goods point of view, have you ever tried to get a tin of baked beans in a French supermarket? It's almost impossible. So perhaps that's something for us to work on.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we weren't for Brexit, then that would be a great growth industry for us to get into, I think. So just to, like bringing this back to the issue of the moment, it is still the issue of the moment, even if they stop shouting about it every 15 seconds to the other time. What does the right kind of trading arrangement for Britain's cities look like? Like, what should be the negotiating priorities in the Brexit negotiations, which are never going to end, which are going to occupy the rest of our lifetimes? What should the government be after to best serve the needs of the economic needs of Britain's cities?
It's about trying to get a deal that is as close as possible to what we've got currently with the EU. Now, obviously, there are all sorts of politics that are wrapped up with that, and it's easy for me to sit here and say this, but ultimately, the position where we're in is that we have got a favourable deal with, or a really good deal with, the EU as it stands. All of our cities benefit from that. Some places in particular, like Telford especially, benefit from that. Any move away from the terms that we've currently got is going to be a bad thing for those different places. How bad that's going to be, it's difficult to quantify. What we do know is that a no deal is likely to be worse than a soft Brexit or whatever it is that we're going to call it this week. But that's what we should be thinking about. That ultimately, you know, there are jobs and prosperity on the line from not getting a good trade deal with this partner. And yes, you know, we can go and talk about the Commonwealth, or yes, we can go and talk about trying to strike a deal with China. That's all well and good. But the biggest deal on the table is the one that we've got already. And that's the one that we should be laser focused on, rather than sort of, you know, talking about, oh yeah, we'll just get a trade deal here and get a trade deal there, when the reality is that not only do trade deals take a long time to negotiate, and you have to negotiate with individual countries rather than a block of 28, but actually we don't tend to sell that much to countries outside of the EU.
So basically, when it comes to Brexit, the softer the better, by the sounds of it.
From a trade point of view, certainly, I think, in terms of how much our different cities across the country trade, a softer Brexit will be better from them than a no-deal Brexit.
Okay. Just to wrap up, a slightly different question. Which cities do the most international trade?
In terms of the total amount of exports, and we do it... So, in terms of absolute amounts, it'll come as no surprise that London is the, one that exports.
Okay, you're going to have a correlation
most,
with population so, size. Yeah, now, let's do... Do you have a measure for exports per head?
So we look at exports per job to try and get a measure in terms of the And it's a comparative measure across different cities. And it's Derby that comes out with the highest number of exports. So we estimate that it's around about £46,000 worth of exports sold to the rest of the world for every job that's in Derby.
This is Derby, am I right in thinking, is aerospace, right? So is it just that there's some really high-value exports there that are kind of bumping up the figures, basically?
Yes, there's Rolls-Royce's activities with aerospace, and there's Bombardier as well in terms of trains. I think it's got the double whammy of, yes, exporting a lot, but also, like you say, a reasonable amount of that is pretty high value, especially the Rolls-Royce element of what they do. And I think that's both... It's heavily manufacturing, but also there's an element of sort of services attached to that. It's not just about selling the jet engines, but it's also selling the warranty almost of the continued sort of servicing of those engines too. So Derby comes out very high. Sunderland also comes out very high too. That is because of Nissan and because of the cars that get exported from there. Although there's something quite interesting in the statistics here. So Sunderland in total exports about £45,000 per head. So Derby was 46, so it's just behind. But in terms of what goes on and how HMRC register the exports, the whole car, so obviously when the car gets exported, the whole car gets attributed to Sunderland. So that's the design of the car, because you can't divorce that out. It's the engineering of the car. You know, the car just goes from Sunderland. Whereas the reality is, and as we've spoken about in the past, you know, the value-add elements of what goes into a Nissan car aren't necessarily done in Sunderland. So Sunderland captures the goodies of, yes, the export went from here, but actually some of the product and the value that goes into that product wasn't created there. So these stats can be distorted a little bit on that front.
And just out of interest, which cities are kind of most dependent on the European Union for their trade?
So Telford comes out as being top.
Telford?
Yes.
Okay, don't hear a lot about Telford.
You don't hear a lot about Telford. That's why it's fantastic that it's come... top of our list.
Fairly sure Telford voted leave.
I believe it did, but then unfortunately there weren't that many places that that didn't.
This is why I'm confident in saying that. Sight unseen, yeah.
Wakefield also was a big one. Again, sort of a place that voted leave. 62% of all of its exports go to the EU. York, which I think probably didn't vote leave, actually. I don't know for sure. That was 63%. So there's a nice little counter-example there. So you get a bit of a spread, I think, in terms of the different types of cities that are most reliant. And there's no particular geography in that. It's all cities in the north or it's all cities in the south. Actually, it's a bit of a spread. And some of that has to do with the quirks of the individual businesses that are there. But, you know, again, to stress, you know, while you have this variation across, you know, the EU was the biggest market for every city across the country. I think Aberdeen was the place that where the EU was least reliant, but we still had a third of all goods and services going to this one market.
Okay, well, Liam Fox, if you're listening, see the error of your ways and resign, please. That's me. That's not the official policy of the Centre for Cities. That's just me. Liam Fox, you should resign. You should not be in government. Go. Go. Thanks, Paul.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I am joined by my colleague from the New Statesman Politics Desk, Patrick McGuire. Hello, Patrick.
Hello.
And we are going to chat about Liverpool, which I think probably this is our third, at least our third Liverpool-themed podcast.
It is.
So I think it is probably the city that's had the most podcasts about it outside London. So well done there. But there's always a lot to say about it, isn't there?
There is, and none more so than this crazy month.
So like, give us the headline. So what's been happening in Liverpool? Why are we talking about Liverpool right now?
Well, polls closed on May the 3rd after a round of local elections in which Liverpool is essentially a one-party state. No news there. The Labour Party more or less continued its dominance in Liverpool. A couple of losses here and there. But the really big news is, at the moment the polls closed, a lady called Anne O'Byrne, who was the deputy mayor of Liverpool, of which more later, announced she was launching a coup against Joe Anderson, one of three mayors in Liverpool. And that was massive news.
We'll get into why that's massive news in a bit. Why does a city need three mayors? Like, we're big on mayors around here. We love a mayor. That seems like overkill. Like, it sounds like to me like maybe Liverpool is a bit over-mayored.
Yeah, well, it depends how you define the term mayor and how you define Liverpool. Liverpool has a directly elected mayor in lieu of a council leader, as some cities do. It also has a Lord Mayor, i.e. just a councillor who gets to wear a tricorn hat and a big chain.
So that's kind of like effectively like equivalent to like Prime Minister and ceremonial president.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Like, yeah. And then there is the Metro Mayor for the Liverpool City Region Combined Authority. And friends of, or you know, supporters of the Liverpool City Mayoralty, i.e. the Executive Mayoralty for Liverpool City Council, get very, you know, uppity when you say, oh, Liverpool has two mayors, because they say, well, no, it doesn't, because the two mayors are completely different. Steve Rotherham, who is the city mayor, has an entirely different jurisdiction and a much, you know, a really different brief to Joe Anderson, who is the directly elected mayor of Liverpool itself.
So let's kind of do some geography lessons. The city region of which the pretty popular Steve Rotherham is the mayor, is not just Liverpool itself, it's also a bunch of the surrounding boroughs, right?
Yeah, so you've got Liverpool, Knowsley, Halton, which is in Cheshire, not Merseyside, a bit confusing. You have St Helens, you have Sefton, where I'm from originally. I'm from Southport in Sefton. There's a separatist movement, but that's a story for another podcast. And you have the Wirral. So that's a fairly heterogeneous sort of mix of boroughs, but you know, Rotherham still won at a canter. And obviously, as you know, I don't need to tell your listeners, and indeed your readers, I hope there's some overlap, what the combined authority does, but it's, you know, much more strategic role, planning,
education, transport, that kind of thing.
Whereas Joe Anderson rules the city.
Yeah.
Bins, housing.
At one point, I'm told he did want to do a giant liverbird on top of Everton Brow, looking down on the city and presumably traumatising the children.
A generation of children. Yeah.
But so, I mean, like, is there any benefit to having these? Because, I mean, they are quite separate positions. It strikes me that maybe the problem here is not administrative so much as branding. The problem is, like, kind of the more powerful mayor in some ways is the one who does kind of city region-wide planning. But he's not the one who gets the good job title. Like, you know, Mayor of Liverpool is kind of instinctively what you would probably end up calling that.
Yeah, I suppose it's because, you know, Liverpool City Council is a, you know, it's a big council. It needs... The problem is that the roles don't actually overlap all that much.
Mm.
Even if there was the Mayor of Liverpool wasn't directly elected, you would still have a Liverpool council leader who was just as prominent a figure in local politics and was, you know, just as influential as Joe Anderson. Obviously, there's a debate to be had there over whether that assertion of mine is true, hence the attempted coup. So the problem is there isn't much overlap, but they do sound the same.
Yeah.
You sort of wonder whether Steve Rotherham's title was Mayor of Merseyside, or if he wasn't called the Mayor, he was, you know, the Chair of the Liverpool City Region Combined Authority, because that's what he is. Or he's accountable to the combined authority anyway. Yeah. If it was
the board that he's accountable to is the council leaders, including Joe Anderson.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly. So, you know, if the roles didn't sound the same, I wonder if, and you know, if it had been taken by perhaps if Barry Grundewald, who was the leader of St Helens Council.
Oh, this is a real person. Okay.
Yeah. if he was mooted,
not the villain from the Harry Potter prequel series.
He was mooted as a potential Liverpool City Region Mayor. You wonder if it wasn't quite such a conspicuous figure. It was like, nobody can name the West of England mayor, can they, right?
Tim Bowles, I can.
Yeah, I could, but I was, you know.
I think the listeners of this very fine podcast probably
do Marvin Rees, and I suppose again they're not from the same party. There isn't the sort of internet.
Yeah, they're
side.
Not from the same party. They rep and also like those two geographies are quite different. Like even though like the west of England is sort of Greater Bristol, it's also sort of not. There's rural areas. There's Bath. Whereas, like, Liverpool and the Liverpool City region are kind of like, you know, if you kind of look down from space and try to draw a line around Liverpool, you would get something that I think is closer to the city region than the council area. So it's a mess. But I mean, okay, why, just from a sort of internal Labour Party point of view, was there ever a move, we'll come back to the present, the most recent coup, but was there a move historically to try and tackle this situation? Like, could they have, like, I mean, when Steve Rotherham became the candidate to be mayor of the Liverpool City region, which was, you know, an election that everyone knew he was going to win, he was obviously going to have to vacate his seat in Parliament, which was Liverpool Walton. Why couldn't they just give Joe Anderson that? Wouldn't that have just made life easier?
Joe Anderson did stand for the selection, and obviously, I wasn't on the NEC, Labour NEC selection panel for that seat. Obviously, I don't know why I would be, because I was an intern at the New Statesman at the time, so it would have been weird if I had been. Obviously, that seat went to Dan Carden, former consigliere to Len McCluskey, now Shadow International Development Minister. He was, you know, found favour with Unite, I believe that is. As popularly told, that's how Dan Carden got the seat.
So is it just like he's supported by a different... Because Joe Anderson's a bit sort of like... He's like the sort of mayors used to get in Chicago 100 years ago, right? He's kind of like a sort of party machine type.
Liverpool has a rich tradition of boss politics. And, you know, local experts have posited that Joe Anderson might be an inheritor to that rich Labour tradition. But yeah, had Joe Anderson got the Walton selection, you do wonder whether, instead of having a mayoral by-election, there would have been a case for, right, we established this mayoralty without a referendum, one of only two cities to do so, the other was Leicester, when a similarly prominent local figure, Peter Salisbury, got the mayoralty.
Mm-hmm.
You do wonder, because then they wouldn't have had, there was no, you know, in other places, other authorities where they've abolished the mayoralties, they've had to have referenda. But, you know, at that point they could have said, well, we've had our fun with the mayoralty guys, Joe's got a seat in Parliament, let's go back to a conventional leader and cabinet system, which is what Anne O'Byrne, who outlined her arguments in some depth on City Metric the other week, was trying to do.
Mm. And like, for all the stuff we were talking about how, like, actually these roles are quite different. And that's true, but it's also not the whole story, right? Because, like, a significant chunk of power that sort of accrues to mayoralties is from the sort of bully pulpit function. It's like basically someone standing up and saying, hi, I am the voice of Liverpool. This is what our city needs.
Yeah, it's interesting. All the criticisms Anne O'Byrne made of Jo Anderson in her article for City Metric, i.e., you know, and indeed in her, you know, explosive statement that was released at 10 PM on that warm evening in May. You know, it was, you know, too centralised, too much executive power, etc., etc. Those were the things that Tony Blair and Prescott, when they tried to revolutionise local government, said would be the strengths of this. And, you know, as you just alluded to, sort of the idea that you have a salesman and, you know, powerful sort of chief executive figure in a city. And I suppose actually the problem is when you are, maybe it doesn't necessarily work in cities where under first past the post, in Liverpool and Manchester, you just accrue so much power, you know, you can rule sort of unchallenged.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool...
You have a massive, you know, Joe Anderson has a massive popular mandate as well.
Yeah, but I mean, Liverpool is so Labour.
Mm.
I mean, like, it is kind of proper one-party state territory. Like, when did that start? Like, give us some political history.
Well, I mean, Liverpool was run by the Lib Dems in the noughties.
It was run by the Lib Dems because at that point, you know, Labour were not seen as left-wing enough and the Lib Dems were seen as a more left-wing option, right? Like, times have changed a bit.
Well, but also, then there's the hangover from Militant and the Liverpool 29 as well, who resigned from the council over the poll tax. But what Joe was elected has been elected both times on the first round of the mayoral election. You know, an absolute cakewalk for him.
If you go back, sorry, sticking with the political history for a moment, you don't have to go back as far as you might think to get to a point where Liverpool was also returning Tories to Westminster, right?
Yeah, indeed, and that's less of a blue vote than an orange one. You know, Liverpool was traditionally, you know, the sectarianism in Liverpool was, you know, historically only, you know, second only to Glasgow in terms of its ferocity and its influence on voting patterns. Only city in mainland Britain to have ever returned an Irish nationalist MP. TPO O'Connor.
Oh, when was that?
That was in the early 20th century. It was very interesting. And also, that is a lot of the character of the local Labour Party, you know, given to plots and internecine warfare and machine politics. Michael Crick expounds on this in some detail in his History of Militant. Has a lot to do with Irish Catholic immigration.
So when you say it was less a blue vote than an orange vote, like unpack like how sort of connections with Irish nationalism get you Tory MPs.
I mean, the unionist, the Protestant vote would return MPs. And until the late 70s, a party called the Liverpool Protestant Party held the balance of power on Liverpool Council.
So you're saying that like people voted Tory to kind of show that they were not in favour of the Irish, the other half.
Yeah, I mean, it was a sectarian, you know, it was a sectarian voting pact. Right. And in the early noughties, as a publicity stunt, Ian Paisley said he was going to set up a DUP branch in Liverpool. It never got beyond the press release.
I mean, that is a hell of a publicity stunt. To be fair to the man, that was a great press release. But like, when did that change? Like, when did like Liverpool, as we said, is now like such a one party state that like more than any of the other Metro mayor candidates. At the point where Steve Rotherham got the nomination, it's like, well, he's going to be mayor. We all knew that. The only question is like how big a vote share he got. When did that happen? When did it become like such? Is that a thing about? Is that a product of the 80s or did it happen earlier?
Post-coalition, the Lib Dem vote, especially in Liverpool, absolutely cratered. Now, the Lib Dems in Liverpool are on the up. They now form the official opposition on the council. Obviously, you know, compared to Labour, their representation is very small, but they're, you know, recovering. Their vote is ticking up in South Liverpool, where they've historically been very strong. You know, Liverpool Liberals, again, masters of machine politics. You know, Jones the Vote, the leader of Liverpool City Council, is credited with inventing Lib Dem campaigning techniques. So, you know.
So like, does the Tory vote collapses at some point? I'm guessing the 80s, maybe.
Yeah.
And then the Lib Dem vote collapses more recently, and that's how we ended up with this sort of period where it's just like Labour across the board.
Yeah, and, okay. You know, are Labour going to lose any of the Liverpool seats or control of Liverpool Council in the foreseeable future? No.
Well, there is one Liverpool seat that's not held by Labour at the moment because it's... Held by
Luciana Berger, yeah.
Luciana Berger of what they're calling themselves now, Change UK,
the independent group. How wrong I was. But I mean, is Liverpool Wavertree going to return a Change UK MP at the next election?
Is anywhere, really.
I mean, depends, you know, I won't repeat the argument made in the New Statesman Live podcast. Listen to that episode if you want to hear the inside scoop on where Chuck might win a seat.
I don't think they've put that one out yet, have they?
No, but I mean, I'm sure they will.
Yeah, well, they better. I mean, they could build it as a live podcast. We worked bloody hard on that.
We did.
But yeah, so just to wrap up, like, do you think in the long term, like, there is this kind of sort of weird dichotomy between, like, Liverpool and the greater region, which has gone by different names. Like, Merseyside is in some ways a stupid name for it because chunks of it, like the chunk you're from, are not actually anywhere near the River Mersey.
Well, actually, most places that are on Merseyside in the most accurate sense of the word are actually in Greater Manchester. There's a great line, you know, which football club is closest to the Mersey? And you sort of straight your chin and go, oh, is Anfield or Goodison Park closest?
Is it Man U?
No, but it's Stockport County.
Oh, okay. That is interesting.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question about demographics. The fear of the Liberal Democrats... I can't remember which way I've got this round, but it has been suggested to me by people locally that Southport, where I'm from, it's now a Labour Tory marginal. It's always been a Lib Dem Labour marginal. The theory, as we go, actually, it was a local Tory who said this to me. As time goes on, as outward migration from Liverpool happens, people move into the outer bits of the borough. You see, already seeing on the Wirral, places become, you know, a place like Southport will become much more like the rest of Merseyside. You know, it's a sort of process of scousification in the same way that you're seeing places like Chingford, places like Chipping Barnet, you know, like become previously True Blue now.
But what's driving that in Liverpool? Because in London, it's driven by housing costs. There's people literally being like, well, I'd love to live in Hackney, but I can't afford it, but I can afford this flat in Chingford.
People,
housing costs are not quite the same in Liverpool. What's driving it there?
People move to the burbs, slightly more pleasant environs. No shade to Liverpool, great city, but
And which has been happening for, like, I mean, a lot of the population of those suburban boroughs is basically the people who moved out of Liverpool Central 50 years ago, right? Like, if you kind of look at the population of the actual city itself, it plummets after about the 60s. But generally, those people did not go to different cities entirely. They just kind of went to places on the train.
Within Merseyside, yeah.
So, like, is it just a continuation of that process, or is there something else going on?
I haven't drilled into the demographic trends quite as deeply as I maybe ought to as a student of my home county. But I just think it's a general, you know, like, you go up in the world, and again, I'm very keen not to throw shade at Liverpool because it's a city I love. But, you know, people move to fancier places, don't they?
We should be kind of bringing this segment to an end, but just kind of bring the story up to date for us. Joe Anderson defeated the coup.
He did, for now.
How did he do that?
Well, so, you know, the plan from his critics was to table a motion at the Labour Group's AGM that would... It was an effective vote of no confidence because, you know, what isn't in the gift of the Liverpool Labour Group to just abolish the mayoralty. You know, they don't have that sort of statutory power. But, you know, it would have been an effective... If a majority had voted for that motion, it would have been very much a no way, Jose. But didn't happen. Joe's candidates won. Joe's slate swept the board. And they didn't even end up voting on the main motion.
So Liverpool's three mayors are here.
Joe Anderson lives to fight another day.
And there's a sort of healthy young upstart, I'm sure, who will live for many, many days to come.
You'd hope so. Yeah. This is strictly ecumenical podcast. that was not an endorsement or a non-endorsement of Joe Anderson. We are merely, this is Joe Anderson's world and Steve Rotherham's and whoever the Lord Mayor is, we merely live in it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Anidge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.